This is Carla, and welcome to episode 14 of There Might Be Cupcakes, Watching the Detectives. Today I will be sharing an excellent song from Haunted Me, called appropriately enough, The Mechanics of Leaving, which I'll be using to wrap around the beginning of my novel in progress, which I began during last November's NaNoWriMo. It's called Watching the Detectives, after the Elvis Costello song, and the cover image for this episode is the book image I designed for the National Novel Writing Month project. The book's plot is based loosely on around a real-life missing person case. I've said that before when sharing my writing, but I've not stated the actual case until now, so y'all get the big reveal. It's Mara Murray. For those of you who do not know, the short version is this. Mara Murray is a nursing student at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, who disappeared on the evening of February 9th, 2004, after a presumably one-car accident on Route 112 in Haverhill, New Hampshire. Before she got into her car, she emailed her professors and her boss that she was taking time off due to a death in the family, which was apparently not true. Some people, due to her actions, believe she wanted to disappear. Some people believe she is missing due to foul play. Some hold the behaviors of her classmates before her disappearance in high suspicion. There was a party about which no one will talk and at which something strange may have happened just before she left campus. Whatever the case, Mara has never been knowingly seen since. I took key points of this case and I let my imagination run wild. So please know these characters are all of my own concoctions and their personalities, foibles and inner demons are not at all intended to be reflections upon those of Mara or anyone else involved. This is fiction. So, before I begin, I will recommend your book through my sponsor Audible and another podcast to enjoy. They're both about the case. First, the book. Go to audibletrial.com/mightbecupcakes. Sign up for a free 30-day trial of the very best audiobook store ever. And chooses your free book to keep no matter what, True Crime Addict, How I Lost Myself in the Mysterious Disappearance of Mara Murray by James Renner. James narrates it himself, and it's fascinating. He's completely honest about his own mistakes and obsessive nature, and he really did overturn some rocks that law enforcement missed completely in this case. The podcast I recommend, and I always do try to recommend another podcast, because when someone else wins, I win too. That's what cupcakes are all about. We all get one. It's Missing Mara Murray. Surprise! Spooky and powerful, it's devoted to exploring every angle and will soon be a fascinating documentary. I recommend starting from the beginning, episode one, and enjoy. I will place links to both James' book and to the podcast in this episode's entry at theremightbecupcakes.com. And now, despite the rasp in my voice due to some inflammation, I apologize. I did promise to read to you. Prologue. If you know something, say nothing. And drink to forget. Mama? Gwendolyn's iPhone pinballed, flailing in the mouths of down comforter where it had been thrown. Mama? The phone case's Swarovski crystals caught with little autumn sunlight filtered through the window, streaking little useless bits of sparkle across the walls. Daylight savings time, Gwendy thought wildly. It's this weekend. Spring forward, fall back. From downstairs, she heard the clattering jangle of the house's phone ring. That antique payphone that her dad had argued with and seduced until it not only worked, but was compliant with Nova phone standards. She loved its look. Bulky and black, techno shit, sexy, something right out of an old bogey movie. But its ringer could be heard on the fucking moon. She knew who it was probably on the phone. She defeatedly dropped to her bed, making her phone bounce and the crystals tinkle shine a little again, and waited. She didn't have to wait long. Footsteps on the stairs, not her mother's studied state attorney in expensive heel stride, but a clattering, clumpy rush. Abigail Hampton appeared in the doorway, looking as if she had just awoken from a nightmare, the worst nightmare. a stock market crash perhaps, or a shady accountant. Honey, you will not believe who just called me. Mr. Burchett, she interrupted. Ever the cautious attorney first, mother last. What did he say to you? Gwendy paused and took a circular breath like she did before training in competition. Breathe in 4, hold 4, breathe out 5, before answering. He told me... She cleared her throat, remembered who she was talking to and about. Asked me not to talk to police. Her mother nodded, leaning against the door jamb, that worry wrinkle she fought tirelessly, starting to fight back again. Same. Speak to no one who is trying to find Beatrice. Help no one, and don't get involved. Share no information, no photographs. Don't even admit to knowing her. Pure no comment policy right across the board. Mama? We have to comply. You know that, Gwendolyn. This is Amos's show. He's in charge. But, Mama... She hated sounding like such a vulnerable little girl with her mother. They weren't like that. But she was seriously spooked. More spooked than when Beatrice had first disappeared. Why would he do that? Why doesn't he want to help us find Beatrice? Gwendy unwillingly let her eyes wander to the photo stuck all around her vanity mirror, locking on the one of BG and Miss Priss and herself, Bendy Gwendy, showing off the obnoxiously large cheerleading championship trophy. She and the Burchettes, all tan legs and white smiles, all future. She looked back at her mother, whose face read only attorney, only legal avenues. It was shut to emotions as usual. Why doesn't he want any help finding his own daughter? It's nice to be liked, but it's better by far to get paid. Liz Fair, shitloads of money. Higher than the treetops next time, bitches! That was always BG's refrain when she wasn't happy with the toss, and she shouted it again as she landed from a flight safely in the basket of her fellow cheerleader's arms. That's how we win, she continued as she was tipped to her feet on the gymnasium floor, bare male and female partners. I don't risk my precious snatch so the female football team can make it to the playoffs. I don't give a fuck about their wins. I want our wins. Kiss your mother with that mouth, BG? Her male base, Calvin Branch, asked as they neatly sweeped her sweat towel out of her hands, just as she was going to apply it to her face. She deftly retrieved her towel before he could use it, took her paws of victory to gloat. No, yours, and blotted her forehead and cheeks. Okay, Root, again, and this time... Higher than the treetops, bitches, came the chorus, this time from most members of the team. BG was the team captain for a reason. She could tell you to go to hell, violently toss you most of the way there by your hair, and you'd thank her for the trip and swear you had the best time getting there. But she was so different outside of practices and competitions and parties. BG was not Beatrice. If you were her friend or her teammate or one of the peers... You just accepted the personality switch. No one discussed it or even asked about it. But there was BG. Then there was Beatrice in class, in front of your average adult. And then there was Beatrice Grace, Daddy's girl. Anyone who did mention it didn't get to hang around long with anyone. Tyler College was not known as a powerhouse on the East Coast or in Virginia. Not for sports, not for academics. It was a quiet, small, picturesque private college tucked into the base of the Blue Ridge Mountains that was known for one thing, exclusivity. Tyler parents paid a great deal of money to make sure that their children studied and partied with the right sort of people, that their children received excellent recommendation letters with District of Columbia credentials attached upon graduation, and that their children's indiscretions, no matter how severe, were dealt with appropriately. The professionals at Tyler College, established 1903, knew how to make things go away. Tyler was academically overshadowed by Washington and Lee and the College of William and Mary. However, even to Tyler's college surprise, the Tyler College cheerleading team and the debate team were standouts. The debate team's successes could be explained by proximity to D.C., by legal blood and political aspirations, Quantico Fire, and congressional family trees. But a nationally competitive cheerleading team? The gossip was that it was the high bitchiness level of the Real Housewives of Horse County in training. Even the mothers of the cheerleaders liked that particular joke. And then there was Beatrice Grace Burchette, Daddy's pride and joy. Her strawberry hair, flushed cheeks, and proud voice front and center, and overhead. She was the chief team flyer, the one that went one, two stories in the air, hurled by her friends into nothingness, into certain death, smiling all the way. There was Beatrice, winning, higher than the treetops. Until she went missing. Tyler College was small, the size of a thriving urban high school, and the peers were quietly in charge. They were just visible, right below the radar of the average professor or teaching assistant, operating inside the ignorance of the dorm managers and security guards. But if you were a student, you knew. You loathed them, you tolerated them, you wanted to be them, but you knew all about them, no matter what bullshit you tried to run. If you attended Tyler College, you knew. BG, Miss Press, Root, Gwendy, Rock, X, Kate Bate. Not all cheerleaders, but a team nonetheless. Beatrice and her sister Priscilla, Miss Press, were both on the cheerleading squad, as they had been in high school as well. Theirs was an uneasy alliance of competition on and off the mat. They both loved and hated to be successful together, and even the other peers wondered why one of them didn't choose a different pet sport. Where BG was angles and toughness and ferocity, Miss Press was softness, femininity, quiet determination. While Beatrice was screaming in your face what she was trying to accomplish, Priscilla was quietly achieving it and surpassing BG's previous record and current goal behind your and her back. And she was flawlessly wearing fake eyelashes, nail tips, and hair extensions the entire time and owning it. Calvin Branch was Root, as sturdy as his nickname, and about as exciting, unless he brought a pill cocktail to the party. But predictable was good sometimes, even if boring was part of the package. It was just too easy to take advantage of someone who wants you to, for a ride, for the pills, for the sex, for the sight of the party. Good Root. Gwendy, sweet Gwendolyn Hampton, who had graduated from high school with BG and a year behind Miss Paris, who only wanted a home and a family. She wanted to earn her bachelor's degree and then her MRS degree, and in the meantime, to experiment with all the drugs this wide world had to offer. She liked nothing better than to get stoned with Rock, do him up in full drag, take him out to a Georgetown bar where the nouveau riche like to flaunt their ill-gotten gains, and make out sloppily with him as openly as possible. She was like BG, a straight-A student in the nursing program. Bendy Gwendy was an asset to the floor. She was the contorting herself in impossible human positions, and then freezing midair so that her stunt partner could hold her up like the bronze figurine on a trophy. She was also the one who could fly, when the routine called for it, across the diagonal width of the mat, while the rest of the team were building a monument to good cheer with their bodies, flipping and flopping the air like a graceful, joyous dolphin. Rock, Peter Beale, was immediately christened Rock for his biblical name. He hated the nickname, so the peers used it as often as possible, because that's what nicknames were for. They toyed with it to make it worse. Again, the purpose of nicknames amongst a pact. So he also begrudgingly answered to Rome and Pope. Rock, handsome, ambitious, and determined to be the first openly homosexual president of the United States. He was not a cheerleader, nor an athlete, but rather like a fat, domesticated cat, demonstrating and luxuriating his overt laziness. He would drape over furniture and read esoteric books, The Golden Bough, accounts of feral children and time slips, Herodotus's histories, while the others stretched and stripped out of drenched practice clothes and rubbed disgusting concoctions smelling of eucalyptus and ambition on each other's muscles. He was deliberately annoying them with, "Listen to this! Can you believe this? Oh, I have to read you something." He would punctuate his unwanted lectures with a forbidden decadent snack for emphasis, teasing with mouthfuls of something they could not or should not eat. Brie, caramel, Swiss chocolate. Alexandra Beverly was their ex for two reasons. One, she was an incredible serial heartbreaker of both boys and men. Two, she was the pier's ex-supplier. She stole most of it from her young father's own supply, and her father's congressional intern helped her get most of the rest for exchanges of certain favors. Kate Bate was underage, pure and simple. While the rest of the peers were 21 years old or approaching its neighborhood, Catherine Day was 18, looked 16, and acted 30. BG was in charge of the cheerleading competition Mets, but somehow, babyface Kate ran the rest of the world, and they all knew it. Kate cleaned up messes, made problems disappear, played den mother, held your hair if you vomited, and they made sure you didn't aspirate in your sleep. But Kate also remembered those problems, who she mothered, and who needed their hair and hands held. Kate had a short age and a long memory. And they were all rich. Rich in looks, rich in opportunity, rich in already wasted opportunities, rich in network, and rich in funds. And rich in frustrations, many of which they could not even name. Nice girls, not a one with a defect. Cellophane shrink-wrapped, so correct. Watching the Detectives, Elvis Costello. Her father, Amos, loved to tell the story of Beatrice's birth. Proprietary of the audience be damned. Teachers at elementary school parent-teacher nights, Washington cronies over scotch and bourbon and cigar smoke and shiny mahogany power tables, again and again at family dinners. Heard it before? Gonna hear it again. Thank baby Jesus, Melchior, Balthazar, and Casper that it was a really short story. Doc told us that being her first baby, if Martha was present, and thankfully more and more often she was not, having her own adult life, her own children with their own mundane birth stories. But if she were present, Martha would look away, biting her lower lip. In disgust? Chagrin? Shame because she was actually her father's eldest, yet he spoke as if Beatrice was his daddy's girl, his oldest, his ride or die. Doc told us that being her first baby, Busy Bee could take hours and hours. Those first babies love the dark and quiet, and they're reluctant to come out, you see. Not her. Bee came into this world the way she does everything, quickly, on no one else's schedule, taking command and screaming in our faces what she was gonna do and how things were gonna be done. He beamed across the dinner table at Beatrice and half raised his highball glass to her. That's our Busy Bee. Either follow her or get out of her way, but don't try to lead her or tell her what to do. Funny, that's exactly what the letter kicking her out of UVA said. Priscilla, being second oldest, also as disgusted by the repetitive family story as Martha, would chirp in if given half a chance. Isn't that a fascinating coincidence? Beatrice would loudly counter that it was not her fault that Priscilla's birth story was unknown to their beloved father, given that her whore mother slut White House intern had lied about her existence until after her birth. Some cutlery or easily pitched item of food would be thrown or threatened. More than one baked potato had been sacrificed to this particular battle of birthright. Then peacemaker Louisa, Beatrice and Owen's mother, would raise her voice over the fray, state that she was everyone's mother, try to beat Beatrice to her usual coup de grace, which was calling Priscilla's mother's knee pads or Mama Lewinsky, and Louisa would clear the table and the room of Burchettes. Once their space were cleared of the human mess and left with the dinner mess, Louisa would gently admonish Amos, asking him why he must tell that story when you know it pushes the girls' buttons. I don't see the problem, was his usual answer. Martha's mother is dead, God rest. And Priscilla knows who her mother is, and they've chosen not to have a relationship right now. That was a, tough time for all of us, and you've forgiven me. And I think if my wife has forgiven me, then that's all that matters. Then Louisa would remind him that questions would always arise among the girls' peers, how Beatrice could possibly be only 6 months younger than Pris. Until they live farther apart, that is always going to be an issue. Who says they're going to live apart? They're going to graduate, marry, and remain in Nova just like Martha. The Burchett name has been in Northern Virginia since the beginning. They're just going to have to learn to get along to go along. Beatrice looked like Amos, who called her, as frequently as he told her birth story, his buddy. She was tall, only a couple inches shorter than he, his reddish-brown hair and red beard becoming her strawberry-blonde horse's mane. She amused herself by using her hair to chameleon. In this picture, she was a lady, sleek Capitol Hill, chiffon and pearls. In this photo, she was wild curls and torn blue jeans, an experienced, smoky-eyed neo-hippie at Lock-In Music Festival. And here, beautifully tamed waves, wide-eyed makeup and a big bow, she was everybody's fantasy of a young, long-legged cheerleader. She shared rock climbing and mountain hiking with her father. Amos and Beatrice would make pilgrimages to the North Face and buy fleece, paracord, and new boots, like other daddies and daughters bought new school clothes and Barbies. From him, she learned the terrifying challenge. Starting in the gym, with those toe and handholds that looked to her like giant pieces of chewed gum, then moving to real natural granite, he would goad, tease, praise, and embarrass her to take the more difficult grip, the more dangerous toehold. In the beginning, she cried, but only silently, tears and snot running into her ears and down into the hollow of her clavicle, wetting the straps of her harnesses and making her face itch, but she never rubbed her face. No, she didn't. She was Daddy's brave soldier. She was tougher than any old pedestrian discomfort. Yes, she was. By high school, she demanded his push and relished every single bruise and scrape, every cheek rash from newly ignored fear tears, every fingernail peeled back beyond the quick, every toenail rubbed down by the top of a hiking boot as it shoved into a crevice again and again. These wounds made her feel like a goddess, but she still carefully covered them artfully with makeup and jewelry. Her public and private stories were like her appearance, strangely fluid. Public Beatrice Grace Burchett was the third daughter in an established Northern Virginia, Nova, family, born in 1994, yes, the same year as her older sister Priscilla. Her family was well-behaved, wealthy, and photogenic. Big teeth, big smiles, and big trust funds. She was raised in a bedroom community in Virginia's horse country with her father, mother, younger brother, and two older sisters, the eldest of whom was from a tragic first marriage. Whisper, cancer. She was tough, fierce, yet gracious and all, also that ever-present Southern cooed compliment, sweet. She knew from sweet. Sweet and iced tea ran in her veins. During high school, she completed extra credit by teaching patients at the hospital in the pediatric unit to knit and crochet. People didn't necessarily gravitate to her for the normal reasons, her smile, the sound of her laugh, her beauty, but rather her determination and drive. She made people want to be taught and led by her. She was raised to excel, and so she did. Cross-country team, dressage, academic competitions, cheerleading competitions, and rock climbing with her family, mostly her father. She relished heights, more of a high than she could ever gain from long-distance running or jumping horses, so those eventually fell away. She honed in with ferocity on cheerleading and became, by hook or crook, every team's main flyer, the girl who was tossed into the air farther than the rooftops, higher than the treetops, for everyone's focus. She could die each time, and she relished that tickle. She knew she mustn't. But, as she reached the summit, she loved to look down, now upon the very small teammates that were the only things between her and shattered bones. 12 feet in the air, higher next time, higher. And think, I am so much more powerful than you. I can fly. I could fly away. Look how small you are. I could purposely land on you. I could deliberately crush you. I could kill you, you know. Kill you. And then another perfect landing and dismount to a cheering crowd. BG loved those suspended higher private moments of being a secret psycho. BG was only BG with the peers, her friends at college. Everyone else, acquaintances, professors, new friends, new dates, new Beatrice. The Beatrice of drive and iced tea, grace and ferocity. Beatrice who took nothing from no one, but who would also let and expect a gentleman to open doors for her. BG was the secret psycho in the air. BG was always afraid, carrying apprehension in his kangaroo pouch behind her sternum, expecting a phone call or a letter or a visit from father or the great yet unknown. BG was afraid she wouldn't push herself to fly higher on that next toss, and was also afraid she would. BG was fearful of fucking the next guy she first dated, and she was afraid she wouldn't. BG was afraid that she would never fully figure out and solve the love-hate-push-pull relationship she had with her sister Priscilla, and she was afraid she would. BG was afraid she would never again take that glorious X-Buzz cocktail that Alexandra had discovered that made BG's fingertips numb and her pubic hair electric, and she was afraid she would. BG was afraid she might die the next time she snuck off solo hiking, and she was afraid she wouldn't. BG was afraid she liked and hated food more than she liked and hated men. BG did not even completely know BG, and she knew it, and it frightened her. And she shoved that knowledge deeper, deep behind the Kanga pouch, in the musty, uncharted dark of herself. O'clock. Do you know where your children are? Priscilla was fierce heat without Beatrice's ignition. People didn't run such a risk of getting burned getting close to Miss Priss. So in high school, Priscilla, who was a grade above Beatrice due to the placement of their birthdays on the calendar, Priscilla was able to overshadow her competitive sister. For a time. Until their father got involved. Amos relished the fact that Priscilla and Beatrice had such overlaps in interests combined with competitive natures. Dressage, cross-country running, cheerleading. Since the girls attended the same schools, the only internal competition available in cheerleading was for captain, and that was only attainable in the top grade of the junior high and high school. Priscilla was captain when she was in ninth grade. Beatrice was as well. Priscilla made captain her senior year of high school, but Beatrice did not. Priscilla excelled at horse shows, winning ribbon after trophy after ribbon, looking like dressage Barbie in her jaw fur and velvet helmet. So Beatrice let competitive horseback riding and showing fall away from her laser focus. Another triumph for Priscilla. Amos would tease and poke at Beatrice, asking her pointedly in front of other family members why she'd taken down her ribbons and trophies in her room, why she didn't have any photos of her and her horse in her room, if she missed riding and jumping. If Beatrice took his teasing like a champ, Amos would take her rock climbing. If not, he would drag her to Priscilla's next jumping practice. If both girls balked at Amos's machinations, which was usually due to external factors, menstrual cramps thanks to synced up cycles, a winter storm, the excessive swampy heat of a Virginia summer, too much schoolwork, the punishment was passive aggressive, but it was punishment just the same. Practicing their sprints repeatedly in their neighborhood, running up and down their street, up and down, past manicured lawns and spindly new trees tethered into place by gardener's twine and stakes, up and down, the only sound their measured breathing and the measured pounding of their running shoes, the sounds of resentment and success. Spending the entire day together doing an onerous task, taking the family iMac to the Potomac Town Center and waiting for it to be repaired, getting both Amos's and Louise's cars detailed, taking the family sheepdogs, hashtag and feedback, to the groomer in the dog park. Sometimes these days would be spent in sullen silence, punctuated by King of the Hill fights over the music played in the car. Others would be spent in secret Don't Tell Daddy glee, with the sisters running around the Potomac Town Center Mall with Haagen-Dazs ice cream cones in one hand and their credit cards in the other. As the sisters went through high school, and Amos's pressure continued, Priscilla turned outward towards friends, towards anyone who was not a Bruchette, while Beatrice turned inward towards Amos and his mountains. Priscilla's determination to succeed was softer, less threatening, more private than Beatrice's, and so she attracted Pierce to her more easily, which is where Priscilla slipped and dropped her glass slipper. There's a certain type of girl who is like a hothouse flower, the kind that grows in mysterious climes and might be poisonous. You teach that girl that she's set apart from other girls, special, meant for greater, and you drill that girl until she reaches a personal peak of physical conditioning. While you are pampering this girl and training this girl, you must also always be pulling this girl up short anytime she shows initiative, because her life is not on her terms, but the family's. She knows always it is about the family name, not her wants and needs. Plus, she knows an arbitrary no can season the pot any time. Wealth and resources, plus arrogance, plus strength, plus resentment. Well, Father dear, you have yourself a little fighter on your hands. Priscilla found quite by accident that an arm well toned through cheerleading and weight training could break a nose. She had not meant to break that girl's nose, Jennifer, Jenna, Gemma, but the bitch wouldn't shut up about Priscilla's mom. Give a girl a gossip magazine and suddenly she's Barbara Walters up in this bitch. Would not shut up. Normally, Priscilla's MO was to kill him with kindness, if for no other reason that it drove people crazy, and she enjoyed that to the fullest. But it was old news that, yes, there had been an affair, God, like there'd never been a sexual scandal in D.C. before D.C. should stand for Dick Caught. But Gemma, that was it, Gemma. She would not stop when she learned that Priscilla's dad had impregnated both her mom and his wife at the same time. If Gemma's attempts at jokes had been a little funny, at least. But no. And then she had to go there. Gemma just had to wonder out loud how many other Burchettes her dad might have created at the same time, like he'd gone on a sperm tour making gingers all around the Beltway. And the next thing Priscilla knew, Gemma was going to need a nose job. Priscilla's parents would be paying for it, and Priscilla had a newfound talent, and it felt good, and it garnered her attention of the most fine kind. And before long, she and some other high school entrepreneurs had established their own fight club. At night, after club meetings and sport practices, they would all meet at the Loudoun County Armory, which had been closed in the 1980s, and would square off. There were definitive rules, all created by Priscilla. Girls started off against girls, but once a bitch had made it past a couple of fights and won, she had to fight guys. No complaining, no free passes. If someone got hurt and needed treatment, the rule was they shared the pain medication prescribed by the emergency room with their opponent. Ongoing treatment required, medication sharing with more members of the fight club was arranged. No one could observe unless they fought first. Then audience was paid tickets only. Two fights per meet, and till divided between that night's winners. No hits to the face to any underage fighter in order to keep the fight club secret and fair. Priscilla pretended it was the thrill of illicit behavior, the thrill of making monies, the thrill of painkillers. But for her, though, and her most secret self, it was the thrill of hitting and hurting another human being. She liked it. And she hated that she liked it, but she couldn't stop. She wanted desperately to bare-knuckle it, but she knew she'd blow open her skin and never be able to explain that away. So she taped her hands to keep them feminine and proper, and landed many blows with her Doc Martin steel tips. Sometimes she'd be kickboxing an opponent, her own street cobbled-together style of kickboxing, and would hear cheer chants in her head. Sometimes she would be performing on the sidelines, thrusting fists in the air to rally the crowd, and would feel the give of ribs fracturing. And then that one kid hit his head. Priscilla had not even known him. He'd never been to the armory before that night, not to fight club, not even to just hang out and drink and smoke and fuck. Samuel Watts. She had forced herself to remember his name, because she struggled to remember his face beyond the coffee with cream color of his skin, and that frightened her. But only a little, and that frightened her most of all. He wasn't even scheduled to fight, but he'd stepped up to go against the fucking captain of the wrestling team. Why'd you have to step up against one of the meatiest kids in school? And Captain Steroids had just laid him out, and Sam fell wrong. It was just a fluke. He fell wrong and cracked the back of his head. Oh, Jesus. Cracked the back of his head on the easement in the back parking lot. And then everything got so still, the stars stopped in the firmament. They all knew they were murderers, teenage murderers. This is it. Everything's over. But no, Sam had not died. That was also a fluke of the lucky kind. Sam had struggled with brain swelling, and it had been serious touch and go. But he was all right after a while. Priscilla didn't want the details of all right. Nope, nada, thank you very much. That's cool, I get it. Priscilla could have been charged with many things but the Commonwealth as the Fight Club organizer, including inciting a riot. But her daddy's bright D.C. lawyer flashed around pictures of how small and cute and feminine she looked in her cheerleading uniform and reminded the Commonwealth's attorney what a pain in the ass he could be, and so on and so forth, and he earned his money very well. Priscilla was sentenced to house arrest. She finished what was left of her senior year of high school on the homebound program, and off to Tyler College she was sent, where she once again perfected killing them with kindness. Sweetness goes such a long way in the South. Now she only punched and stomped in her dreams. She did that often to the sound of cheer chants. I say green and you say grew. Green, blue. I say fight and you say win. Fight! Beat him up until the teardrops start, but he can't be wounded because he's got no heart. Watching the detectives, Elvis Costello. Calvin Branch. From championship football player in high school, with a firm eye on the professional prize, to cheerleader in college. The center of everyone's attention, to the sidelines, to cheering other bastards on. And at Tyler College, known as Fix You or Fix It You, to boot. Quite a slide, and even he could not believe it. Some nights when he awoke to the sound of his roommate's snores or his roommate's furtive masturbation. Root liked to pretend that he was confused at the route his life had taken, how he wasn't playing football at Michigan or Ohio and being groomed for the NFL upon graduation. But he was not at all confused. He'd left a trail of breadcrumbs, chunky and thick. What was that one phrase that college coach had used, the one that his dad has insisted speak with him? Ah, moral turpitude. Turpitude. Nothing but a fancy way to say, fuck you, boy. You soiled one of our purity ball princesses. No football for you. Part of it was revenge. No, he wasn't supposed to think like that. He'd agreed with his therapist that a therapist signed by the court as part of the plea agreement. It wasn't revenge. That girl wasn't vindictive. She was seeking justice. He was paying his dues. Blah, blah, fucking blah. It still meant he was a cheerleader instead of a hero on the field. Granted, cheerleading meant a lot more hands-on with hot chicks. His sport was holding bitches in various positions, usually by the inner thigh or the ass. And cheerleaders were so much easier to read, to be with, than normal girls. They were more blunt, more honest, more in your face. They want something, anything, they tell you. Hell, they demand it. And they don't pretend. They don't pretend to be old school, old South, with a purity ring and a pedigree and a cotillion gown while doing the same goddamn things in the dark. Fake bitches. College cheerleaders are more honest in their presentation. This is the part of my life where I am pretty and dolled up for the crowd, where I'm a very good, clean girl but still flesh and skin, and this is the part where I do what I want to do, and I want to do a lot. They could balance lady in the streets and freak in the sheets with integrity, not this blushing debutante, I never, bullshit, where they act out and then have to act like nothing happened or act ashamed. But, yeah, a deal had been struck. That phrase always made Calvin think of a cartoon blacksmith, anvil and hammer, bam, ting, and his future was gone, flattened into something else. As part of his plea agreement, Calvin had been willing to agree that the case would remain on the books, not quietly tucked away with the other indiscretions, rapes, of the sons of the very rich. He had signed that piece of paper, exchanging no prison time for no privacy, meaning that every time he was looked up by salivating college recruiters, his fine, fine play stats were marred with a scarlet letter. Calvin still struggled with what had happened, wrestled with that particular encounter's definition, just as he'd wrestled with her. She has a name, Corinne. Corey Slessor. Compared with all the other times he'd engaged sexually with anyone else. What was different? Had there been a sign? Then, as now, Calvin was the helper of his group. Rides, sex, the place to party. Adderall, usually stolen from his little brother Punk, never took his meds anyway. Corey was almost always there, always ready for a 1-2 buzz of a fruit roll-up, his specialty. He'd pry open a handful of Adderall capsules, empty them into sweet wine or those fruity wine coolers the chicks like, add a little Molly, then you blend it with ice and more fruit. It really got the party started and made the bitches' kisses taste amazing, comforting in a way, like summer and picnics. Had there been anything different this time with Corey when they'd finally fucked? On the way back to the party after a grocery run for more beer, liquor, fruit, and ice? They pulled over in that side parking lot where that Chinese restaurant used to be and... and what? One time recently, he'd freaked himself out. Rude had been having sex with BG, both of them rolling. All loose, warm limbs and no gold, just naked and high. And then suddenly he'd remembered and he was in the car with Corey. And he was coming and lost in it and coming. And BG was punching his arm. Hey, fuck her out, goddammit! And he came back to the moist, echoey pool room gym to find himself above an extremely annoyed BG, with his fist buried and twisted in her reddish hair, lifting her head off the poolside concrete. The reflected light in the chlorine that was not the parking lot street light played in odd patterns on the wall behind their heads. BG was so cool, so cool. Next time you want to pull my hair, just tell me, asshole. Now you have work to do. You fucking came too soon. So he got to work. When BG tells a guy to get to work, he gets to work. And more often than not, he enjoys being ordered around. So what was different? When he was drunk or stoned, or endorphined up from working out or sex, he was convinced there had not been anything different. No sign. Alcohol and liquor and testosterone ranted at him from inside his brain. Oh, that bitch got caught by her daddy or her boyfriend or some shit, and you're the fall guy, and you lose everything, and for what? For some slut's pretend virginity? That wasn't rape. I'll fucking show her rape. Ecstasy and endorphins purred to him as he danced with or piled up in a happy heap of humans with X or Kate Bate or Rock or BG. Jesus, BG. No, man, Corey had a crush on you, and you liked her, too. You cared about her. Your boyfriend found out you liked each other and took something really cool and made it ugly. He's the one that got revenge, not sweet Corey. You should call her, totally call her. The events of that night were all tangled up in his head, like old headphone cords rendered useless by misuse, by sloppy storage. He couldn't remember sober or stoned what had actually happened anymore. He had memories of seducing Corey, of their whispering and awkwardly shedding only necessary items of clothing and giggling all elbows and knees in the back of her Audi, and he had memories of biting down on one of her sweater shoulders as he pound, thrust, move, take, bite, 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 and he was so close to coming, so close and far away, and right there he could hear a kitten mewing. He sailed through the world, guided only by the dim lights of impulse and habit, confident that his course would throw up no obstacles so large that they could not be plowed over with sheer force of momentum. Donna Tartt, The Secret History. Peter Beale cultivated an aura of strange. He liked that it repelled the average American teenager. It allowed him to tease out the kids that who either weren't superficial or who were actively attracted to the weird. He constantly tweaked his look, for he took incredible pleasure in unsettling people. Whether he had affection for them or not, he lived to be a passive instigator. In high school, he would have a several-day run of dressing like the pedestrian rabble, as he referred to the other pop culture-ridden students. T-shirts, jeans, loafers or sneakers, and bam! Velvet smoking jacket, complete with ascot, over-strategically ripped thrift store pants, and perhaps slippers with curled toes. People would freak. You'd think I'd dropped a bomb of gayness in the middle of the quad, he'd tell BG when she demanded stories of being gay in high school, and they were all going to catch a fatal dose. Then he'd go butch, stealing clothes from his older brother who worked construction, or his stepfather who worked the disability system. Tight white wife beater, tight with showing jeans, shit kicker boots, the whole deal. With showing? BG had asked, her eyes sparkling with the glee that only comes from having made other people uncomfortable, even if only secondhand. You know exactly what I mean, girl, he'd responded, taking an overly dramatic pull off the bong for emphasis. If I'd squeezed into the step bastard's jeans, that skinny motherfucker, you could measure my girth on Google Earth. BG had cackled, happily drumming her heels on her dorm room bed. When you are the only out homosexual male in a small town below the Mason-Dixon line, you have to amuse yourself so that you don't go insane. You also have to make yourself so ostentatious that you either spook the bullies, make them think you're unstable and dangerous, or you entertain them and they have to keep you around. Peter thought he'd achieved a tasty balance of both. And now he was at Tyler College, the island of misfit toys for the families of rich and ambitious, and he fit in just fine, thank you very much. His mother had ditched the deadbeat stepfather for a new, nouveau riche one, and new Penny Papa did not so much enjoy having an audacious stepson. No sir, no howdy. So when Peter expressed interest in the small liberal arts college isolated in the valley, new Penny Papa wrote a big fat check at the speed of ink. Not only was Tyler College geographically isolated, surrounded by Virginian mountains, but the closest place to truly get into trouble was the resort of Massanutten, and that required a fine allowance. And no one had suggested Peter would be getting that now, did they? No howdy. Also, Tyler College was isolated from the gossip mill of the D.C. Beltway, which is what made it such a perfect choice for Fix-It U. If the brats fouled the second nest on the way to redemption, and perfect cap teeth, and sound bites, and arm candy, and enviable vacations, and enviable power, Tyler College could handle it in relative privacy, just between them and the relatives. So Peter majored in literature, mainly to frustrate new Penny Papa. How the fuck you gonna market that? Do you plan to declaim sonnets on street corners for cash? That's a fabulous idea! And quickly took up with the frenetic inner clique of the cheerleading team that called themselves the Peers. They drew to him because he had impeccable taste in pot strains and excellent connections to obtain them, and they stayed for the eccentricity. Rock, Rome, Pope was their entertaining house cat, lounging about while they ran about and leapt and jumped, stretching and purring and reading and watching. Rock had committed no transgression to attend Tyler College, and that amused him most of all. He loved striding across the faux New England campus and watching anxious faces pass and wondering, who'd you rape? Would you steal? Who'd you try to kill? Rock was at Tyler College because, in junior year of high school, he had read Donna Tartt's The Secret History. Twice. Back to back. He relished the idea of such an isolated, tree-drenched campus with unusual, brilliant, kooky rich kids where something dangerous could happen around any bend. Could be made to happen. It would happen. He was happy to wait and watch the fuse flicker, maybe blow on the flame if need be. Encouragement was a good thing. Now fear is here to stay, love is here for a visit. They call it instant justice when it's past the legal limit. Watching the detective Elvis Costello. Catherine Day, officially at Tyler College because she cheated on her SATs. You can't mess with those government exams and expect to go to a good kid's school. That was the official story. Catherine Jailbait, Kate Bait. Truly at Tyler, because gated communities only protect their privileged and pampered residents from the outsiders. When the expensive gates are locked and all the high-tech cameras are shooting away, all that security cannot protect the snuggest neighborhood when the predator is already inside. The very best horror movies have that hook, right? The killer is in the house. The monster is one of us. Don't go in the basement! Throw all the Barbies, Girl Scouts, private schools, the right summer camps, the right friends, jewelry, spray tan, nail lacquer, Chanel, Louis Vuitton, and spring breaks in Cabo San Lucas and Monaco at a girl. But if she's a monster, she's a monster. Pretty is as pretty does, and pretty doesn't touch underage neighbors in a gated beltway neighborhood. Pretty does not, above all, embarrass her family. So, Catherine Day, Kate Bate, matriculated into Tyler College early after hurriedly getting her GED through homebound study, all rushed and hushed by very expensive, do you know how much this is costing us, D.C. attorneys, and the said attorneys working with the special staff at Tyler who handle such cases to create the SAT cover file for Catherine with accompanying whisper campaign. Kids talk, and the press talks here at Northern Virginia in the Beltway. You give them something, and they won't go looking for more, and poof, underage neighbor sex scandal goes bye-bye. That still leaves the 13-year-old girl, whose head had been left spinning by her first girlfriend, her Katie, who'd made her feel strange and magical and dirty and scared all at the same time, and who didn't understand why Mom was crying and Dad was shouting, and why she was having bad dreams, and why she had to go off to boarding school without saying goodbye to all her friends. But her parents got paid, and they got paid well, and everything got hushed up, and it's all gone but the nickname. Money fixes everything, even when your kid molests a neighbor. Ah, the American way. Oh, our Kate? Yes, yeah, she's already in college. Early acceptance at Tyler. She was bored in high school. She's so intelligent. Left her junior year. She and her guidance counselor worked out this really smart plan with college administrators. She'll go for Tyler for 2 years, acclimate to college life, prove she can handle the work, and then she'll transfer to either UVA or Georgetown. They're both already fighting over her. What? Oh, yes, we couldn't be prouder. Our Kate always makes us proud. We cannot wait to see what she does next. Who's going to tell you when it's too late? Who's going to tell you things aren't so great? You can't go on thinking nothing's wrong. Who's going to drive you home tonight? Drive the cars. Every privileged, smart, rich, white girl from the best families and the best gated communities and with the best connections has a battle plan. She has this battle plan before she's old enough to know what it is, to know she needs one, and certainly old enough to understand that she will have no hands in forming her own battle plan. What might be included in this battle plan? It depends on where this girl lives. Definitely emboldened bullet points for major rites of good girl passage. Baptism, purity balls, confirmations and bat mitzvahs, daddy-daughter dances, homecoming courts, proms, debutante balls or cotillions, first country club mixers with the right sort of boys, their very own membership to the country club, admission to the right college with just the right career path. And never fear about that left-hand ring finger. Daddy and Mommy will lock that shit up. They know what's best for baby girl and who is best. They've had fine ideas about what they want their daughter's last name to be since she was born, and they have most probably been working towards that goal over hands of bridge and highballs and handsy slow dances at the country club with other women's husbands. Oh, baby girl has choices. Beatrice had choices of what college to attend for undergrad. Daddy and Busy Bee had it all worked out. Her mother Louisa didn't need to worry about a thing. Really hadn't been consulted much once Beatrice had found her voice, which had been early. Beatrice's plan included a well-heeled southern school for undergrad, with a historical and political grounding, an esteemed D.C. alumni, the University of Virginia, Georgetown, perhaps Chapel Hill or Duke. Maybe Washington and Lee if she and Daddy were feeling, I don't know, avant-garde. Then definitely something near the center of power for grad school, most likely Georgetown. One branch of the master plan that had both Amos and Beatrice salivating was nursing undergrad at UVA, with training at the University Hospital, and a combination master's in public policy, a juris doctor from Georgetown. She could be poised to be a policymaker for the CDC, the Surgeon General's office, any of a number of congressional committees. All that power smelled like pipe smoke, tweed, and old money. Beatrice Grace was going to save lives and run shit, and she didn't know who was more turned on by that idea, her or Daddy. Martha, good, dutiful older sister, and denizen of the D.C. Beltway, was roped into the recruitment and recommendation part of this plan. Martha Burchett Cotterill, due to her exceptionally strategic political marriage to a high-placed fat cat Washington attorney, was in the perfect place on the chessboard to present her shiny penny little sister and her need for recommendation letters for college and her master plan full of dreams. Because Amos and Beatrice had been so carefully cultivating Busy Bee Beatrice Grace's master plan, her name was already somewhat known. She was that pretty redhead at the country club balls, the daddy-daughter dances, the purity balls, prom queen. She sang the national anthem at that one event, right? Sure, I'll write her a letter for UVA. I'm UVA 64 myself. Jefferson School proud. So Amos and Beatrice applied to UVA, Washington and Lee, and Chapel Hill, saving Georgetown for grad school. Busy Bee got into Chapel Hill and the University of Virginia and chose UVA. UVA not only has a stellar nursing program, but is also surrounded by the Appalachian Mountains and sports an indoor bouldering wall. She could rock climb to her heart's content while studying anatomy and learning how to draw blood without blowing a vein. Heaven. And then. Beatrice might as well have ripped the master plan into small pieces and thrown it out her car window while driving down Highway 29, and thrown Amos's heart right after it, though he never said so. He didn't have to. It was all hushed up, of course. Amos was privately, not publicly, humiliated, so there's that. And his Busy Bee made it up to him. Oh, yes, she did. Everything's going to be all right, Daddy. And with the help of Timothy Keene, student legal representative, she finagled a deal with UVA. If she left quietly and never used UVA on her resume or CV, never claimed allegiance nor relationship with President Jefferson's school, charges would not be pressed and events would not be made public. Out of respect to her father's reputation and high standing in Washington, D.C., and her sister's husband's as well, and to the generous donations to the school given by Burchett's over the years to UVA and other historical monuments in Central Virginia, a devoted, upstanding Virginian family with long-standing ties and demonstrated devotion to the state and to its heritage. A misunderstanding. A series of misunderstandings. She hadn't meant any harm by using her domain's credit card number to order takeout. She'd misunderstood, complete misunderstanding. That student had said he would order food for the floor any time to hit him up, and he'd left his card on the desk. Yes, that was a lot of pizza and takeout Chinese for one girl. Yes, Beatrice had a single dorm room, no roommate. No, Beatrice declined to discuss the logistics of the purchases made. She had made reparations to the students in question, and he had therefore declined to press charges. Misunderstandings. Shoplifting from the campus bookstore? No, Beatrice Grace Burchett did not shoplift school supplies from the bookstore. Beatrice walked too close to the entrance of the bookstore, holding some Sharpies and a notebook while talking on her cell phone, and she stepped outside to get better reception for her call. When an employee spoke to her, Beatrice remedied the situation. Yes, those store items were tucked under her arm. She was trying to balance her bag, those items, and her cell phone. Just a series of misunderstandings. Perhaps an ill fit with the nursing department. Indeed, an ill fit. It happens. Such things happen. And, well, such errors should reflect poorly upon the admissions department and the nursing department, not the college student. They were the professionals. And besides, Beatrice was able to account for and return almost every single pill that she stole from the pharmacy. No true harm done. No victims here, considering she only took the pills for herself. As Representative Keene explained, she had no intention to sell or distribute. No intention to hurt anyone. Beatrice Grace Burchett is a good girl who is going to school to learn how to help and heal others. She didn't even truly realize she was doing wrong. She was overly fatigued from so much coursework and so many practicum hours. She couldn't expect to be held fully responsible for making good choices as a sleep-deprived 19-year-old brand-new nursing student. And where was the supervision? Beatrice should never have been alone and left alone in the dispensary with all the drugs. Now, whose fault was that? Not Beatrice Grace's. Now, really, isn't it best that none of this goes public? For everyone? I hope you've enjoyed this abridged window into the first part of Watching the Detectives. If you have, I will be very happy to share more later. Until then, be extra good to each other and keep trying, like I did today, dragging myself to physical rehab. There just might be a cupcake on the other side, like this podcast episode. I just want to put a special thank you on the end of this episode for letting me share. This has only been since April. And I have 2,250, over, as of now, downloads, 19 reviews on iTunes, and they're all 5-star, and all of the ones that have been written have made me cry. Yes, all of them. I appreciate every single one of you as individuals. This is a really fun journey that we're going on together, and I love sharing it with you. And I want to hear from you. I've started a group on Facebook for the page. I'll repost the link for it. I've made it secret so that your individual posts do not show up on your timeline for friends and family to see. But membership is not restricted. Just ask to be let in and whoop, alakazam. Thank you so much for everything. And I will see you in a week or less with more of my weird interests and stories and viewpoints and my writing. And I am really, really proud of this episode. This might be my favorite yet. So I hope you enjoyed it. Until next week, be sweet, but not too sweet, because remember, there's a reason salted caramel is so good.